right, Carl, you done on Tinder?
Hold up. Text myself.
It's having Black Leprechaun.
Gotta hit one.
Now I know how to find the gift.
Oh, you didn't know that?
Oh,
no. Oh,
that's what I never thought.
Oh,
of black
it's, yeah, it's about a Black Leprechaun scene in the neighborhood.
It's the Heckleproof Comedy Podcast with Zach Bolton and Carl Lee and Maddie J. Tonight's episode, music producer Anthony Cosenza.
Oh, what's up, guys? Here we go. Welcome back to Heckleproof Podcast. Still doing it, still loving it.
We back.
I'm your boy, Carl Lee.
I'm Zach.
And I'm Maddie J.
And let's show some love to our sponsors. Boom, represent.
Check it.
Hawaiian Hut. Got that good teriyaki chicken and that amazing macaroni salad.
Wow, that was so good.
Amazing.
I think we need to get paid more after that.
And also Chadwick, show mad love to Chadwick, Chadwick's Comedy Club, Chadwick's Pub.
And Medford Rotten Custom. Carl was messing that one up, so I'll take
messing that one up.
Right. Didn't they change their name though?
I think they did.
You messed it up still.
You messed it up.
Levi's gonna have to put their
real what is it, Carl? What is it?
I'll find out.
Oh, man. We are just blowing it.
Levi will flash it up on the screen.
Yeah, Levi will save us.
Yeah, Levi will do his research. He's like, these motherfuckers kill me.
And this poor gentleman that's mashed in between all of our egos today.
Who is this man?
Right, this is Mr. Anthony Cosenza. Hey. Nice to be here.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is the first time I've talked one of my friends into being on the show. Normally we've been interviewing.
I know, exactly.
You guys as friends.
I heard this was a professional show.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm sorry to disappoint you so immediately. Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about my favorite topic, really, me. No, we're going to be talking about music because you know this podcast has gotten musical on several occasions. I think some of our best little clips are us doing one of the
impromptu.
Yeah, we always refer to music somehow.
That's true.
In our podcast,
it only makes sense if we circle back around. And here's why this is cool. Because not only is this fine gentleman somebody that I've been involved with in the scene with for years and have watched him grow and evolve as a musician, but he's also a producer of music, which a lot of people don't fully know what producer means. They think producer, they think Hollywood show is if he's the guy that makes sure that we all have the coffee and donuts available. No, a producer typically of music is somebody who will possibly compose the entire song, sometimes put together the song based on ideas, but always make the song palatable for the general public.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a big kind of deal to get a chance to talk with a producer. And hopefully today you'll learn a little bit about what goes behind the scenes of making music.
Yeah. We could talk all day about that.
You could talk all day.
That's true. And Zach also is a buddy producer, so I thought it might be interesting for
dabble in there.
So. I say you more than dabble, man. You do a great job. You have some stuff that I really enjoy listening to, so.
You've been holding out on me? Like, I'm on your podcast, I don't even have
I know you're going to be a big critic, so I got to wait until I bring something.
Right, that's true.
Are you still making beats and doing something?
I haven't gotten the making beats part. That part for me, I struggle with. That's a little that's a little hard, but I do lyrics and cover songs or beats that I've purchased. So.
Nice. But you're actually recording the whole thing.
I have like $10,000 worth of recording setup that I have at home that I, you know, every now and again I'll get into making music.
Mm-hmm.
Get an itch that I have to scratch.
I still remember the day I was 8 years old and I saw the first guy with a drum machine.
Mm.
And I remember it vividly. And I'm like, I want to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
is that and when can I get one?
Yeah.
Right. So you were 8 and where were you when you went?
That was Michigan. And
Was he in the studio? Was he just sitting at home with it?
Yeah, it was a friend, and luckily his parents both had a band, and they had their whole basement was converted into a studio, and it just blew my mind. I knew I wanted to do that, you know, at a very early age.
Wow. So you did it for quite a while. So you started around 8?
His mind started.
Yeah, no, that just gave you a passion for it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And when you see that gear the first time, that's what really changed for me.
Oh, for sure.
Got to see it up close.
And also the generation that we're from, gear was just coming into the space age. You know, as far as we were concerned, this was futuristic Jetsons, robotic style stuff, you know, because we came from analog
stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, even the synthesizers, open them up back in the day, mm-hmm. they were moving parts in there. It wasn't just all microchip based. So it was interesting. I know as I saw stuff growing up as a kid, anytime you saw a little glimpse into how music was made, I was like glued to whatever I was watching, or if I got a chance to watch a band practice or something, it was like,
boy, these days the tools are amazing. There's so much stuff out there.
It's crazy.
Right, and that's like, for example, with Zach, if he has an idea, he has a world available to him of different beats to select. I remember trying to put together some hip-hop stuff when I became interested in it back in the day, and finding a beat that wasn't just so cheesy and just full MIDI.
Yeah. Well, I have a microphone that's, it's called a Slate, digital Slate microphone.
Nice.
You probably know of it. It emulates, a program too that you have access to, it emulates,
bunch of different
100 different microphones, so you can get,
These sound great.
Yeah.
These sound really good.
Yeah, these are good. These are sweet, Rode.
It's like, I was like, fuck, I just did it recording.
I know we were talking about that before. It's hard for us not to actually start the show, because we just start talking in here.
Yeah,
your own voice sounds really good through this setup.
So you want to hear more of yourself.
That's what got me into music. I was love hearing myself, and I was like, that sounds cool.
Well, that's
like
really
being
cool.
able to monitor it while you're on the microphone.
Because some people can't stand their own voice.
I can't stand hearing my set. Like,
you
I
think
can't.
You know what it sounds like, and then the first time you hear it recorded, you're
like, what?
Can you turn down the suck? So, like, I don't know, with me, it may be different. Everybody's musical journey is a little different, but I know for me, what got me introduced to wanting to get studio gear and wanting to learn recording is because I was raised as a poor black child. I was raised with just enough money for like an acoustic guitar. We had a piano, but that was where it ended. That like kind of bankrupted my family. For them to be able to give me that was a big deal, right? And so I mean, the opportunity for me to record a song was never going to be a thing unless somehow I could learn it.
Yeah,
if I could get the gear and I could learn how to do it, then I could record
mm-hmm.
and I could produce. But there was no way some kid from a farm in Eagle Point was going to mm-hmm. be able to produce. And that's the beautiful thing about what Anthony's doing, is he gives some kid from a farm
mm-hmm.
the ability, who has gotten an idea and beautiful lyrics, he can say, this is what I want. He gives them a venue where he can create
mm-hmm.
everything you need to help you put out your art.
That's cool you know that about me. That's weird that you do, though, but like a lot of the times, I mean, I get paid for a lot of the stuff I do, but a lot of the time, if I can help anybody, that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
I know, a lot of the time, it's in people in different countries who can't afford it. You know, they don't have the gear. And like a guy in Jamaica hit me up the other day. He's like, I want to pay you to master a song. And I'm like, I'm probably still not going to take the guy's money. Like,
right.
I probably won't. I'll do the job for him for sure and just kick it back to him, and it's going to be good. But and we'll work together in the future, and I'll probably get that money from him sometime.
Right.
So much of it is just doing stuff for people that so they get it done, because I know what it's like not to
you
get.
You know what it's like. That's it. You know what it's like.
Well, and like even the name of your studio, which if it's still the same as Small Axe,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what does that mean to you?
Small Axe takes down a big tree.
Exactly.
Small Axe. Oh, I see. Axe.
But I also like the idea that if you say it fast enough, it sounds like Small Axe. And here's the thing, like when you're a budding musician and you don't have resources and you have nothing but heart and
mm-hmm.
an idea, you have little brother energy. You come to somebody else and you literally plead with them, like, please help me. And it's a big axe,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a way.
Yeah.
Like, please help me put my music out. And I love that, you know, what you're doing is like, A, it's cool, but B, you're also winning awards and shit. Like, he's being all humble over here. Like, yes, sometimes I've been able to do something.
Right.
In the reggae world, you know, they'll know exactly who we're sitting with.
Mm.
Although it goes slightly by a different name, which I know you as.
Yeah.
Which is Ross.
Ross Cricket.
Ross Cricket. Oh. Your, her
stage name and that kind of thing.
I like that.
Right.
That was actually, let's see, 20 years ago. Wow.
And you got that name.
Yeah,
that was not a self-imposed.
Right.
No,
typical white reggae song.
Do you have a story behind how you got the name?
My friends called me Cricket when I was 17, like in Michigan, before I moved out to Oregon.
Okay.
When I moved out to Oregon, and I was so steeped in reggae, just doing it all the time, and then friends of mine called me Ross Cricket, and it stuck.
Hmm.
And 20 years ago is when I first started putting that name with some of my reggae productions
mm-hmm.
online, and yeah, I still talk to a lot of people from around the world that I knew through that website where I posted my music, and it's really encouraging because it gets other people to do their stuff, you know. And just like with you guys with comedy, when you encourage each other to be better comedians, you know.
Right.
So it's cool. Yeah. It's been a long time going.
And so you have, how long has your studio been operational? Like from the first time you were able to record what you wanted to do, let's say all the way through now, how many years has that been?
It's been about 12 that I've had it back here in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
When I moved back from Washington, I came with everything that fit in a car.
Mm-hmm.
Oh wow!
And so now when I get those new guitars or something, I feel really happy or proud about it because I actually did work and paid for that mm-hmm. stuff. And
right.
There you go.
Oh, I have told people that so much. Like some of the stuff I've bought from shows that we did with the band, it doesn't matter how meager that thing was. It's the fact that that came from music money.
Yeah.
You know, like mm-hmm. I get these royalty checks every great once in a while, and they're not big.
Mine aren't either.
but if you realize how many thousands of plays it actually takes to make $1.
Yeah. Exactly.
It does feel bigger mm-hmm. when you get that check, but it might only be like 20, 30 bucks and you have to be okay with it. At least it's something, right? But whatever you buy with that $20 to $30, it's like every guidance counselor you ever had, every non-supportive family member. When you cash that check, it's like, who's wrong? All of y'all. Who's right? Me tonight.
All of y'all.
Oh, man. That's great.
No, I love seeing people's musical journey. Now, what was the first instrument that you played?
First, technically, was violin.
Oh, wow. Mm. Okay, so that's something I didn't know about you. Nice.
No, it's really weird. My sister, she's 6 years older now. I was probably 3 years old, I guess the story goes. My family still tells me all the time. But I can remember the day, because she's doing this exercise called peanut butter sandwich.
Oh, wow.
Dun, 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 dun.
Oh, yeah.
I'm this kid, and I can hear her doing it. And in my mind, I picture what needs done, and I'm sitting there waiting for her to do it. I'm just like, please do it right.
Not doing this
please do it right. And I just went up, and I guess I grabbed the violin, I put it on a coffee table, and started showing
her.
Yeah. And everybody were like, okay.
Like, maybe this kid is supposed to be doing music.
Oh, what's funny about that, though, is that what was going on visually for me in my head, like, I could see it. And, like, when I first started listening to music and like, Chuck Mangione had a very famous song
Chuck
in the 70s.
Cold, boy.
Cool, instrumental. But the melody would go through my head, and I would see it and visualize it. And
before you could even really play.
Right.
You're, like, envisioning what their arms are doing or
all
what their
kinds
bodies
of things,
are doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so music's been a visual thing as much as audio almost, you know, like I see the shapes or whatever and it's weird.
That's dope.
Yeah.
And I think the interesting thing to me is like knowing that you spent so much time in the world of reggae and yet having jammed with you and having gone out and listened to you play in various different ways. One of the things I find interesting is that you play all different styles of music. There's very
Thank
few
you.
Musicians I know that dabble in lots of music. And like, for example, Dave that plays with us in Legendary Good Times, our bass player, he plays so many instruments and he's phenomenal.
Yeah. He's really good.
Anything that he touches. And I've noticed that you as a guitar player, I've always said you're like a chameleon. Cause every time I've seen you on guitar, you just sort of like merge into whatever style of music is being played.
I like that because like when you're tasked with doing recordings for other people and that kind of, they might need something different and you got to step up to it. So.
Right. So, and that's an important thing. Sometimes like for a guy like you, this is an interesting thought. Like if you go into the studio, right, every once in a while, depending on your role in the studio, you might not be there to be you.
Right.
You might be there to just fall in line with a nice mix of somebody else's style and not put your flavor on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense for sure. So you don't stick to just one genre. You kind of, you know, whatever.
Try to stay hip to a lot of them because you never know when that day to get hired for something might come.
Right.
Well, that's why
good. That's a good outlook.
That's why you got Quincy Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Being that man that he is, because Quincy Jones produced so much music that people don't even know that mm-hmm. that was his. I'm talking about in his 60s producing white artists.
Yeah.
Writing for producing songs for white female artists in the 60s.
He was
60s.
Like, he was seeking out artists.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Producing.
And you have no clue that was Quincy Jones. You think that's not.
That's because of him.
That's not crazy. Soul music. That's not. But Quincy was just, it's just like he said, like he doesn't just stick to one genre. He wants it all.
Right.
I mean, he wants it all.
That's what makes music such a beautiful thing, is there's so much that happens behind the scenes that people don't really understand. I mean, a lot of these, there's a producer that's of my generation named Benny Blanco that does a lot of pop and like rap stuff, and he's put together.
He started when he was like 12.
Yeah, right? Grammy award winning songs, and nobody knows who he is really, except for he's on that show, Dave, Lil Dicky's show, that, that he's kind of made a little more of a name on himself, and he's on TikTok. He always makes fun of Charlie Puth on there. They go back and forth. It's pretty funny.
But, yeah, I watched this a Netflix documentary about pop music, and it has about eight parts to it. And it was about, one of them was about the bands and the producers coming out of Sweden. Sweden, because it started with ABBA. You know, when the Swedish people heard,
I don't know
ABBA,
what exactly started, but it definitely something started.
Because ABBA is a Swedish band.
Oh yeah,
they're a Swedish band. So you know, the Swedish people heard it and it was like, oh, because ABBA knew in order for us to make it big, we got to get to America. We got to learn English. That we got to sing in English, and so. All the songs are English, so all those, you know, people who had that the passion and the desire were just picking up on it, and I learned that so many of them became producers for like the Britney Spears, the NSYNCs, and all these hip hop artists. All these people, like, watch that documentary about Sweden producers,
right?
And it's amazing.
Cool,
what they were doing is like
that's one of the things that cracks me up about pop music too, because like, I started messing with pop music a few years ago with one of my own solo projects, because I have all these weird ideas that don't always work in a band. And I think any musician will tell you sometimes you get haunted by an idea, and sometimes the only way to unhaunt it is to put it out there, to get it out of your head. Record it down, then all of a sudden it's gone and you don't have to hear it all the time.
Yeah.
But some of those ideas can be gold, and if you never do anything with them. So I started this project years ago to like do my own weird songs where I record all the parts and do all my pieces and stuff like that. And what I learned from doing that is the same thing. Like I would have people come in and work with me on various parts where I'm like, hey, I want to have a vocalist come in. And normally when you do that on anybody's project, like, you're just falling in line.
Yeah.
You're just making them sound better. And I would always tell them, like, no, I'm having you here to make me sound better.
I want you to actually do you, you know.
Well, that's what a lot of artists were doing, like Denise Williams. You familiar with her? She's an R&B singer from the 70s, 80s. She sang back up for Stevie Wonder, and she sang back up for James Taylor.
Nice.
And she went on to be an amazing solo artist. But they were like, I need you. I need this piece.
Where I need
and
you. When, Aretha Franklin.
Yeah. And when Led Zeppelin.
She was the same way.
No. Who's seen Sweet Home Alabama?
Oh, my gosh.
Sweet. That's.
Who? Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah, okay. I should know this.
I should have known that, too.
So I'm like in a classic rock band, just about. I should know that.
Me, too.
Because if you listen to the chorus, that's a black woman singing that.
Huh.
Right.
She's singing that. And he knew about this black woman, so they woke her ass up in the middle of the night, like, come to the studio, because you know how you guys work late sometimes. Idea could come at 3
you gotta do it right then.
Yeah, so they woke her ass up, and it was funny because she would tell the story how she was in the studio with all these white folks and they singing about Alabama. She was like, what the fuck
is going on?
She sang that shit with anger. You might think she was in there jamming, like she was we gonna kill these motherfuckers.
That's one of the magical parts of studio stuff, I think, is when you get those ideas. Like, you're in the middle of a song, sometimes you'll be like on hour 20 and you're just working on one part. Like everything is working in the song, but there's like one part that's just not working for whatever reason. And, you know, you get to that point where it's like, either we need to quit and come back tomorrow on this, or we need to, like Mutt Lange, go for 150 takes until you get the perfect take.
Yeah.
You know? So I was having
a slave driver.
Yeah. I was having one of those nights, and I was doing some solo stuff, and I was actually producing a reggae song, which I was really unusual for me, but I thought, oh, I'll take a stab at a reggae song. Right. I live in Southern Oregon. Why not?
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, I got all the qualifications. I'm white and I live in Southern Oregon. Let's go. Shot.
I feel guilty for that somehow.
You shouldn't.
Okay.
But anyway, so I'm like, okay, how do I produce reggae? You know, this is new to me. And so I start off and I'm like, well, every good reggae song's got a keyboard part, you know? So I start off with kind of the syncopated keyboard part. I composed this thing, and I got this buddy who used to be in a great band called Soul Survivors back in the day. They were one of the greats. And they kind of really got a big following. And this vocalist they had, he was just this kid that didn't look like he should be in a reggae band. He looked like he was a trucker's kid, you know? And he's fronting this reggae band with such this like damaged soul.
Foam hat.
Amazing voice. Yeah. And then, but he was also a total like goofball.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, years later, he's now that band is defunct and he's kind of just out doing his own thing. And I called him up and I said, I wrote a reggae song. I want you to come sing on it. So he's there and we're producing it. And I'm like, man, something's missing. Like it's this killer song. The lyrics are amazing, but something's missing. And I'm like, it's fucking reggae. Like we need horns.
Yeah.
Mm.
Right. And so he goes, you know, he has a very particular voice too. And he looks at me, he's like, oh, like I know a guy that plays horn. We could probably call him right now. And, like totally get him. And it's like fucking 10 o'clock at night or something. Like we've been recording all day. He's like, yeah, let me just make his call. I'll call this guy. So sure enough, he's like, yeah, I got this friend. And his name's Brian and he plays saxophone. He's really good. And
Big B?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so and that's how me and Brian started. So nice. Anyway, he goes, I'm pretty sure I can get him over here. And like, tonight? Yeah. He calls this guy, and out of nowhere, this fucking guy, who is originally not from here, he had moved here, and he's like a world-class saxophone player, shows up at my tiny little backyard studio, and in the first fucking take, lays down two perfect horn parts that just took this song that was a really cool song into being something that's actually like commercially viably sellable reggae song.
Wow.
It really made it legit.
Nice.
And it was one of the best songs on the record. And it was nothing more than a moment of us going like, ah, what do we need? And him going like, I got a buddy and straight up calling Brian.
That's so crazy.
And Brian like ended up playing, he's played with you in your projects. He's played, Brian Reisling is his name. He's played with, Legendary Good Times. He did the same thing for us. He came into my band a couple years into us being a thing, or maybe 3 years into us being a thing, and made us sound like a grown-up band all of a sudden.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. You get that saxophone
player.
That's
a good way to put it.
Yeah, that's what it does, man. Mm-hmm. It just takes it to a next
level. That class to it.
And that's what, again, like a producer, that's their job, right? Mm-hmm. So their job is to take, you have an idea for a song, you record something at home, you send it to a producer, what do you think, right?
Right.
And his job is either to make it sound as good as possible based on what you have, or his job, if you've asked him to, is to be like, okay, here's what you need.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a killer track. I hear this. I hear that. We could call in this person. We could connect you with this other talent. And the more that Anthony works with different artists, right, he can connect the dots like that.
Yeah.
So he might have a badass vocalist.
Yeah, man.
That really needs like a killer guitar player, but like a guitar player with a true Jamaica vibe, not just some regular guy. It's gonna do chicken picking, right? And he wants something with that
chicken
feel.
Chicken picking.
Right,
chicken
but now picking. You got a network of people that you can sort of
make
connections.
That's so awesome. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I've struggled with the most with making my music is I get to that certain point, like you say, where you may be working on the same part for like 5-10 hours and just can't quite get it right. But I have an idea in my head and I'm like, this is
you
what
can hear
I want
what
it.
It's supposed to be.
Or I know that there's a way to make it sound this way. I just don't know how to do
that. My advice on that is when that happens is step away from it because it should be, I'm sure you can crush it within like that 2 hours or 1 hour, you know?
Yeah.
And when that's not happening, just find something else to do if you can, because just you can't really force it. I'm sure that's probably the same with comedy. While we're talking, I'm thinking of a lot of analogies with comedy between that and music.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Someone posted up the other day how they're having a hard, they sat down to write bits, but they're having a hard time to write. I'm like, I've never done that.
See, I have no idea how you guys do that.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody.
I do both, but I definitely find it's way more productive when you're just doing something else and all of a sudden you get a funny idea and you're
premise.
Okay, I better stop.
Let me write this premise down and I start with that.
With a lot of my music is, you know, driving in the car, I'll just listen to instrumentals or something or I'll be in the shower and I'll
You ever do that thing where you sing a melody into your, because you know that's like, that's your hook.
And then you put words to it.
And you're in the middle of the day and all of a sudden you're like,
record that hook. I have so many.
And if somebody else listened back to your phone, they would think you were a fucking psycho.
Yeah, that's my biggest fear. That's why I have a lock on my phone. I'm like, don't go.
That's hilarious.
Right.
It's not because of porn or anything. It's just the stupid.
Yeah, not the porn.
Look at my private
photos. Watch the porn.
Don't listen to the voice
you
memos.
You can watch all my dirty home movies.
Don't read my unedited lyrics. You're gonna see more of my heart than I want you to.
That's so funny.
I have the weirdest lyrics in my phone too, because I don't know. Like if you're like me at all with lyrics, like I don't get the whole song at once.
Hmm.
I'll get an inspiration, and it might only be like two
lines of mm-hmm. a song.
Yep.
And then I'll write that down, and then later I'll come back mm-hmm. and write a song around that idea.
Yeah.
But I get those ideas all the time. And sometimes cool. I read back around the idea and I'm like, that is the stupidest fucking thing
yeah.
ever. Why did I even text that to myself?
Yep.
Like, I need a better filter.
I do that sometimes. Listen to it and I'm like, nah, that's not the way I
want. Or it sounds super sappy. Like,
yeah,
I don't really want to yeah. put that out there now.
Like, yeah.
At the time, it sounded like I was really burying my soul. And now it just sounds like, I don't want people to know.
I don't want people to know that.
I don't want people to know.
I'm all for burying my soul as long as it's so a good, funny. Good side to be seen. Like, you don't need that side that's crying in the bathtub. Yeah, rocking hilarious. Back and forth. What have I done with my life?
Yeah, I can watch music documentaries all day. I just watched a dope one on Rick James and how his mind was working.
I'd like to see that.
Amazon. It's on Amazon. So Rick James was pretty cool. Is and you probably know this about Bob Marley before Bob Marley was a Rastafarian. And he was. Mm-hmm. He was like a doo-wopper.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, and the same thing was for Rick James. Rick James was, he idolized the Beatles. He saw the Beatles and was looking like a black Beatle. Eddie Murphy claimed he was the first black Beatle.
That's hilarious.
But
no, it's true. A lot of people were trying to find their sound by just emulating what was out there.
And so when he was on the run, and he went AWOL from the military.
Oh, wow.
So he was in Canada. And that's when he was, you know, was picking up some of that sound. Then he came back to the States, and he heard Parliament Funk, and he heard, like, Sly Stone.
Okay.
And he was like, oh, so this is what's going on?
Yeah.
I can do better than this.
Right. Oh, man.
And so he went from fucking doo-wop to that bump, 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 bump. It was like just the way his mind was working. It just – but – it was amazing because I watched him, Parliament Funk, George Clinton, how all them guys were doing. Who else? Can't remember who else. But you got to be such a fucking control freak in order to have that type of fucking music. To be you know what I mean? Because it was all them. It was like, this is my shit. This is what I'm doing.
It's that old school band leader thing you don't see much anymore. Like, you still see it sometimes, but not very often.
Not so, it's different.
It's like, remember the movie that was about James Brown that recently came out?
Yep.
If you watch that, you see how much
another control. One. A control freak.
Yeah.
Very insecure.
But that also.
James Brown, control freak?
Right. Yeah.
If you played a wrong note, you get fired.
Man,
you
or fined.
Fired
or fined.
Yeah. I mean, try to do that today. Try to tell one of your musicians in your band, like, right, you, hey, by the way, Anthony, you messed up on your solo, so that's $15 off your pay. Like, that would end up being somebody leaving a band over that nowadays.
And he ain't picked up one fucking instrument. Dave didn't play one fucking instrument.
No.
Oh, yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. He played the crack pipe.
You want me to play that?
He played that well.
Bitches. That's what
he had a wind instrument for a moment.
He played them bitches.
But I will say, you know, most music, what people don't realize is, like, you can have all the ideas that you want, but most musicians aren't studio guys. Most musicians just know how to play one instrument. They don't know anything about recording. They don't know anything about anything other than performing and songwriting, right? And so I think what's so important with people that are interested in music is when you hear kids that are like, oh, man, I really wish that I was talented. I wish that I could do this. I always encourage kids to get involved in production. Mm-hmm. Not to say that producers aren't talented, but it's a different type of talent, and there's so many aspects of it. Like, in the old school, in the 70s, a music producer was not the same thing either. In the 70s, a music producer was like who you hoped to sign with. And they would tell you what you were going to release. It wasn't a collaborative. Right. It was they were the ear. You were the doer. They would tell you what to do. And if you played game and played ball, you got to have a record. And
you could be the next big ABBA.
Maybe one or two of those songs was actually your idea.
That's how rap is right now, really.
But with pop, it's teams. It's like what Carl was talking about. It's whole teams of people working to write what actually is some of the most simplified music that there is on the planet.
Yep.
That's what is the biggest ironic thing to me, is that, like, the biggest pop hits that you hear, like, you know, the stupid, like, you know, Chandelier song and stuff, you know, that just plays on the radio forever. That, if you look at the writing credits, it'll have like 8 names on it.
Exactly.
Yeah, totally.
There's like only 14 words in the whole song. Yeah, and they have like 8 names on the song.
Yep. Chandelier. Chandelier, okay.
And then there's a guy there's a guy there that's literally like, that's why he's on the team. That's why.
Well, and then he gets a writing credit for that. That's why I did this.
Well, who was I listening to? Somebody was saying that, like, they They made it so that everybody can get a cut from royalties from that, cause, so they put their names as writers. I think it might have been Boys to Men said that. Some of us, but they said that that's what they do. They looked out for them, like, even though you didn't do much in this shit at all.
Right. That's cool.
And even if you didn't sing lead, like you didn't, you never sung lead on any out songs, but still they put you on.
Which makes sense in a group, but if you're like that pop artist, like I would be like, how many people wrote that song? How many people do I have to pay? Like the last song that was written by two people, we had two people to pay. Now there's eight people on this. But, I think I'm getting scammed.
But like you said about jumping in on that production side, I came up with Pharrell.
Right.
Oh yeah,
I came with Pharrell.
That guy doesn't age.
And I never forget, man. Like we did a talent show. My group, my lead singer, he was drunk, so he didn't make. It was like some shit straight out of Five Heartbeats. Just like we had that one drunk in the fucking group that was making shit hard for us straight out the fucking. And we were just trying to be like Boys to Men / New Edition. That was our thing.
Yo, New Edition's my jam. I like
We were, and that's what we were focused on. And we were like, we were making some noise back east, man. So we want to go to this talent show that Teddy Riley put on. And Pharrell had his group in there. And fucking Pharrell got picked. But just like you said, the whole thing about production studio shit, Pharrell went in there and started writing with Teddy on shit. Like, remember fucking Rex and Effect? Check, baby, one, two, three. But that's Pharrell's part. Pharrell wrote that fucking part. Yeah. So after that, it's like him being in the studio with Teddy, that's when all that growth was coming from. Like, yeah, you can have a desire.
Well, and those guys and solidified their career for years. It's one thing to be a rapper, but if you're also a producer, guess what? You're still working.
Yeah. You're working hard.
Yeah.
And it's amazing though, because I remember I grew up loving Commodores, Cameo, Confunction, 20 piece bands. Average White Band, all those guys, right?
Like I was talking about that. I wanted to put a funk band together so bad. I just love funk. I always have. And it's the hardest thing to do would be to put together a funk band, because it's like get 20 people.
20 people is just
to align.
Yeah.
You need four guitar players.
And 20 people whose significant sacks, others trumpets, all get along.
Bongos.
Stand around people.
Some hype men.
Hype men.
You need some hype men.
Yeah. And,
but nothing is more fun. But also nothing is more unattainable. I mean, think about the troupe that's required and how much money you have to ask
to be. I remember watching the Commodores go from 15 to 4 motherfuckers.
Yeah, right?
Because
it sure did.
Because now it's not about instruments anymore. We got synthesizers,
and that we got people to pay.
Yeah.
So that we ain't got to fucking pay you guys no more. Yeah. Now we got a machine. We can keep the four dudes that started with us back in 66.
We got some robots.
Lionel.
66.
Lionel wasn't having it.
Yeah. And it was like weird watching, like, damn, man, that's fucked up how, like I can go back now and watch Confunction, Commodores, Cameo videos. You can see them back in the 70s. Like, now in the 80s, early 80s, the motherfuckers went down to four dudes. And then they had the keyboard. You know how you had the keyboard?
Oh, yeah.
That shit started changing.
One poor guy would have multiple duties, you know, because, like, they couldn't afford to get the fifth guy. So one guy had to be, like, the keyboard and the bass player. So, like, when he's not playing bass, he's, like, trying to...
Keyboard and bass.
He's just trying to finger everything all at the same time. Kind of like Zach. Really, in many ways. That's what you would have in common. Yeah.
I don't know which button it is. I don't want to take a guess.
One of the things,
take a guess.
One of the things I wanted to talk about, because like this is something to me that's really, really cool. Is I love it when, as a music fan, when I get to hear a little bit about like philosophy. And so I've got a story that I'll, just a brief one that I'll tell after I ask you, because I'm always curious about what people's philosophy is. I mean, we've had a chance to jam together. So like, I feel like we do speak a language already.
Yeah.
Sort of know where you come from. But in your opinion, like if you were going to sum it up for any type of musician, doesn't matter what you're playing, like when you're on a track, when you're working with another artist as part of a band or a duo or whatever, what do you think the most important thing to keep in mind is? Like if you're going to be on someone's record or if you're going to record a music part as part of a band, like what would you give somebody like advice-wise? Like what do you keep in mind when you're trying to be the best version of you, I guess?
Like I said about making comedy analogies, like you play to the room, like you play to the song, you know, what serves the song best. That's what's going on. Like you can go in there and serve yourself or be like, here's my sound and this is me all over this. Or you can walk in and just try to meld into that the best you can and not necessarily have to sound like yourself, but what serves the song.
Mm-hmm. See, and I love that that was his answer, because we have not premeditated this conversation in any way. I told him I'm not going to give you any idea what we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. But
almost called you too. I was like, what are we going to talk about, bro?
I know, right? I know.
People want to know. Yeah. I'm like, oh, it's heckle proof, man. We keep it fresh.
They keep it fresh.
Keep it fresh. But what happened was I was watching this show and they were interviewing, it was MTV out of all things, and they were interviewing a bunch of musicians about like what makes a great song. And as part of this show, they'd come down to a part where they're talking to a bunch of different guitar players and a bunch of different piano players. And they're asking them like, what's your philosophy of, you know, what's good? And man, like there was just so many answers. Mm. There's so many answers. And then they go to a shot from this thing that's called NAMM, which is a North American music something conference show. It's a big show for like all the newest instruments coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And also for a place for people that are really solid players to like expose themselves as mm-hmm. available. So at the show, they pull this guitar player from like a band like Rat out of the 80s. Just mm-hmm. this dude that hadn't worked in years, right? And they pull him in this thing and they said, in the fewest words possible, what's the best advice you could give to a musician when it comes to writing a song? And he literally said three words: serve the song.
Wow.
That's exactly what this cat just said. And the reason I asked you is because I had a feeling you were going to say that.
Yeah, that's dope.
After having played with him. Mm-hmm. Like, I tell this story. I told, I think, Zach in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, one of my best memories that we have is we go to this guitar event that happens multiple times a year. And I always look forward to seeing if you're going to show up, you know, because we like jamming together. And we don't get to jam together very often. And I think it was the second time I was there. The first time I was there, I was fucking terrified, man. I didn't feel good enough.
Yeah, I feel you.
I did not feel good enough to be invited.
And that's another analogy when it comes to comedy. Oh, like, man, when I go to comedy festivals,
it's just like, it's a whole different thing. I'm in a room with heavyweights, right?
Yes. I definitely know that feeling.
And these guys are just, they're not like world famous, but they're like famous here locally, right? Yeah. So we're in the room with like these local celebrities, if you will. And these jams are normally super fun. But what always happens in a guitar room when you have a bunch of guitar guys is egos tend to take over, right? And so, like, if you're a pretty humble player, you just sort of, like, look around and go, like, oh, man, I'm in a weird spot here because everyone's really trying to show off. Mm-hmm. And, like, I just came to have fun. And so it's my second year. First year I was super nervous, but the second year I came and I was like, all right, I'm good enough to be here, damn it.
I'm going to nut up and play some guitar.
I proved myself the first time around, and I played multiple instruments. And so, like, it's cool. I could fit in multiple rooms. There's, like, three different jams that happen in three different rooms. It's a real cool thing. So I end up in the electric room, which is my favorite room. It's where all the amps and guitars are, of course.
Okay.
So Anthony's there and me, and there's, like, I don't know, four other guitar players that are there all in one room with this poor drummer and bass player that contend with these guitar player egos.
Oh, gosh.
And so it's very much like this cheesy kind of like blues song that always tends to happen at these jams. Like, you have these ultra talented guys and they fucking play like Mustang Sally. It's like, come on, guys. You're all so good. And I'm always hoping for the organic jam. Like, let's just play without paint by numbers. Let's just play and see what happens, right? So we're playing this silly bass song, and as the different solos are happening, it kind of goes around the room, and each one of the guitar players is just like, man, right? Just like, look at me. And they're just like putting all their testosterone and ego into every note they're playing, right? And then they're looking at the other guy like, beat that. Right? and that's how this order of things goes. And so you're like standing sort of like where you are, and I'm where Zach is. And so it came around to you. And I remember, like, you just did this real tasty blues jam, but you weren't like trying to blow anyone out of the water. You were just like serving the song, right? So you're just doing what sounded good for the song. I was like, man, that sounded cool. Here these other guys are, you know, it's like trying to do three-hand tapping on a blues track. Like, what has happened? You don't put Van Halen on the blues. So anyway, it comes to him, and now I'm like, I'm feeling intimidated, right? Because I'm not that great of a soloist. I'm a rhythm player.
Okay.
Which people love at jams. Mm-hmm. But if you put a rhythm player on the spot, a lot of times you get like a very like Guitar Hero sounding solo, like blink, 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 you know, like you're missing notes. So anyway, when he's playing, I start kind of changing the rhythm up because I hear a different like chorus, or not chorus, but like melody that goes along with what he's doing, right? So I kind of change up the rhythm and I'm playing this cool little rhythm shift. he picks up on it, he starts jamming, so then it switches to me, and he kept doing what I was doing, you know, instead of just like dropping out, like, okay, I'm done, you know, he's right there like supporting as I'm doing my little mm-hmm. solo piece. And I just left this biggest impression, because immediately after that, the whole thing cycled back around again, and there was another guy that was like literally calling him out, going like, riff for riff, riff for riff. Come on, riff for riff. That wasn't fun. And it's not fun. It's not like, this should be a fun
jam. So what was his reason for ego?
Yeah, he wanted to, here's a younger player who clearly threatened him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had to step up and show that he was the alpha guitar player. And like in the grand scheme of things, none of the musicians in the room really cared about that. We were just there to have a good time.
That's what I'm thinking.
But
we had a great time that day. And I'm glad that you remember that, because it was fun. It was like in this whole room of people, like you and I had a moment and a good, just good fun.
It was kind of like, you see what's happening right now? And we're both looking at each other like, man, we should just be jamming.
Right, right.
And then I think we did. They were playing cover songs, and finally we were like, we need to just jam, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think the drummer there, he was like, yeah, let's jam. And so the three of us just busted into a jam, and everybody had to follow it. And it did kind of change the whole thing, because now all of a sudden, these guys who were here to show up and show off, like that solo they might have been practicing for 2 to 3 weeks, right? They weren't playing that song anymore. So now we changed the game. If they pre-wrote anything, their game was out the window. Now they had to improvise, and I think it scared them a little bit.
Yeah.
They're like, but I wrote this for Mustang Sally. Like, that's what we always play. Mm-hmm.
So I remember, man, when my group, because I'd never been in a recording studio, and I still never have been in the recording studio, but we recorded a song, and I never forget, it was like, when I was growing up in the apartment complex, right below us was these Siblings, and they were a cover band of Prince. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about Dirty Mind.
That's not easy. Where were you growing up?
In Virginia.
Cool.
Yep. I'm talking about Dirty Mind. Remember that album?
Mm.
So that was during that time. So that's
not easy to play.
Yeah. Man. So I will never forget, when I would come downstairs all the time and hang out with them, and I had this derby. I don't know. I think I got it from Musical Youth. Remember Musical Youth?
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely remembering.
The kid from the league had a derby. Bro. And I had a fucking derby, like kid from Musical Youth, because I was that same age. And I told people to me I looked like him. So I was always into music, because it was New Edition, Musical Youth, right now. So I used to go downstairs with them, and they used to jam out. And I used to try to sing lead for them while they played with me Prince songs, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So they did a lot of rock and roll. I'll never forget, like 38 Special. It was like Prince, a lot of good shit, man, back in the early 80s. So as I got older, started forming my groups, coming full circle back with them, they were now ready in the producing place. So they produced some of our music for my group.
Oh, that's cool.
And the crazy thing about it is, like, I didn't know shit about no studio, never been in one. So we recorded our shit in the bathroom.
Oh, yeah. No, and you probably got a good sound on
it. They put up the what is it called? The shit, like the padding.
They
had us in the closets and shit. Like, dude, I was like, these motherfuckers, like,
probably did work out pretty good. Kidnapping
us. We got to harmonize. That's music we tied up, but we got to harmonize.
That's one of my favorite things about producers, though. Like, you don't realize, like, in order to do what that is now, you have to be able to play music, you have to be able to record music. But more than that, you have to know why you're recording, the reason, the way that you are, because of recording, that's a whole art. And one of my favorite guys who we're going to have on eventually too is Mark Johnson, who I know you know.
Yeah.
Mark Johnson, he's a studio, what they call audio engineer. So his specialty is recording people. And he's played on some of my music before too. He's also a fantastic player. But whenever you get to work with one of these guys, man, the knowledge that you have in your head blows me away, because I'm like a budding producer. I've only done my own stuff like, you know, some friends of mine. But the way that things are recorded, it would blow you away, man. I remember working with Mark Johnson and him putting my amps in his shower. And he's like, we're going to get the best sound out of your amps if they're in my shower.
That's crazy. Some of those early recordings, like The Doors, he used to sing in a bathroom. The Beatles used to do snares in the bathroom.
What producers inspire you, like coming up in your years? What producers were you looking at? Like me, like, you know, they ask comics, mm-hmm. who's your favorite comic? I can lay 30 comics out for you. They were like,
you might know some of those names.
Yeah, exactly. You might know, exactly.
Well, like you were saying, like you mentioned New Edition and those kind of things. I listened to that stuff coming up. I mean, the list is really long, but like Yeah, I love a lot of that kind of music, and Prince as well. I mean, but as far as favorite producers, I got so steeped in reggae that some of my favorite producers are definitely reggae cats that a lot of people might not know or whatever. But and you said musical youth. That's funny because I want to say I was 6 years old when I had that record and loved it so much. I loved that whole band so much and didn't even fully know why, but it was like,
I don't know why I love this, but it's in me.
Yeah, because honestly, it was like they were considered one hit.
Yeah.
One, but I had the whole album, so I played it all. So I was like, oh, this shit. And that was probably my first introduction to reggae. I heard it, probably didn't know what I was hearing.
Mm-hmm, me either.
Didn't know I was hearing Bob Marley. Probably didn't know what I was hearing, although, because before there was Bob Marley, there was other reggae legends too.
This will make you laugh. When I was in third grade, I remember trading a pin with a guy in class for his my Thriller, Michael Jackson Thriller one. That's Michael Jackson. Right. For his Culture Club pin, because I like Culture Club, and I didn't know why, because they're a reggae band, and that I liked the bass player. I could tell he knew what
he was doing, something different.
Yeah,
it's like the Police. Were you a Police fan and didn't know?
Yeah, a little bit.
See, that's a good point. A lot of those British bands had a reggae.
Yes,
a lot of
it's just the bass player was on the up, or the keyboard was on.
If you go back to the 80s, and you listen to those British bands in the 80s, they all has a reggae feel to it. It just made that shit that much better, like you said, that maturity and that class and just that feel. So
it's true.
They didn't affect it so much. I mean, even had like, you know, Dire Maker by Zeppelin, which had this big reggae feel in it. Like it broke into classic rock. It got into everything.
Yeah.
It was much like Soul did the same thing. Mm-hmm. Soul bled into everything.
Well, hell, that's why you got like, that's why you see all those British singers. Them motherfuckers can sing.
Oh, yeah.
Those were Elton John, I mean, like, even Duran Duran, all those guys can sing. Like, David
I was honestly
Boy.
A little bit worried when she started losing all that weight that somehow I was going to change her tone, because she had such, like, a big sound. Sure.
Yeah. They thought the same thing about Luther.
Yeah. Right, and I love it how, like, it doesn't matter. No, you know, like, Aretha Franklin could have been, like, a size 2 and still belted it out, you know? Yeah. Well, I mean, look at Amy Winehouse. Like, she was, like, a size 2 and still
She was amazing. Yeah, she was really good.
Her voice is phenomenal.
That's one of those, like, if people always say, like, if you could resurrect a dead artist to work with, like, she's always on my list.
So raw. Her voice is so raw.
Yeah, I love voices that sound like that person's just had a shit life. I don't know what it is.
And you know,
it's a horrible thing to say, but, like, the worse off your life has been, the more I want to hear you sing.
It's got that rustic feel to it.
Well, you know, listen to Temptations' David Ruffin. David Ruffin. Like, you think about all them groups like that, those Motown groups, that sound, they had so much passion in their voice because it was so much that they were experiencing through the civil rights days, poverty, discrimination, all that stuff. So they...
And it always sounded happy, even if it wasn't.
Yeah.
So that was the interesting thing, man.
Right.
So, like, David
reggae
Ruffin...
Reggae can do that, too.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So David Ruffin grew up... he was abused. He didn't have a... His parents didn't love him. They were abusive. A lot of neglect, and he carried a lot of that pain forever, and he died high, actually. But David Ruffin, if you listen to some of his songs, he just belts all that shit out because he's just singing from the core of all his pain, and he just waited for the fucking bottom to fall from under him, like, because this is too good for to be true, for me to be in fucking Group Temptations, but he could never accept, like, dude, you all right. You're in good hands. You got a good thing going. He could never accept
That's a good thing to bring up. Like, was there a point for you when... Because I know there's always a point for every person that's doing anything in music where you're like, I'm going to give this up. It's not working. But what was the point for you where, like, I guess you realized it was working? Like, where you realized, like, not only should I be here, but this is where I'm meant to be. Was it over time? Or can you, like, look at maybe one thing in particular where you're like, oh, shit, okay, as much doubt as I might have, this is really where I need to be?
So I'm originally from Flint, Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
I was born there. And
Draymond Green.
It's probably when I was in the studio, and the next studio, I was 15 or 16, and some people had me in to play some guitar, and in the next studio over was DeBarge.
I was just about to say that, because they're from Grand Rapids.
It totally from
Grand Rapids.
And I was like, oh, I made it.
Right.
Or at least, oh, I made it. I'm going to be doing this, you know. So it was pretty
fun. And they were a Motown group. They were they were going to be the next Jacksons.
Yes.
Yep. The barge was the shit. The
barge was large.
The barge was large.
That's what I love about this podcast. If you follow us long enough, you get music recommendations.
Yeah. Obviously. And your ass will be sitting at your computer just referring to going to Google shit.
Okay, what was it that Carl said I should look at?
Musical Youth. Like, damn.
What was that band from the 40s that Maddie was talking about?
Oh, man. I love how you make me out to be the oldest one. It's just because Carl don't have no gray yet.
I got a little bit. Yeah. I'm looking at you two. It's like, damn.
I'm getting there. These guys are going full blown John Travolta already.
I blame
John Travolta got gray.
I blame my children, but like in a good way. I wanted to go gray. I was one of those weirdos.
George Clooney,
he was the, like, he was the first guy that made.
I saw Gandalf.
Cool, I think.
Oh,
you know, like Gandalf. Early on, not like late.
Like
early on, like the wizards of yore, if you will. I saw those wizards when I was a little kid, and I was like, man, I dig that. Like, that long white hair, that's cool shit.
That's cool.
Like, other kids were like, I want to be a fireman. I'm like, I want to be Gandalf.
Yeah, I want to be Gandalf.
I was thinking on the way here, and you mentioned about Ruffin, who's singing, and it's all that passion and everything. And I thought on the way here, I was like, thinking about blues. And one of the things about, you can't fake it, and that's what will make good music in general, but blues especially is one of them that requires a lot of emotion, or at least requires knowing from a place of pain, without the lack of a better word.
Absolutely.
And this is funny because when I moved out to Oregon, I was 18, and my best friend at the time was like, I think he was 55, older dude who played harmonica, and this guy Red. He was amazing, and he showed me how to grow weed and all kinds of stuff and just cool shit. And, like, it was amazing having a really older friend, and we got along so well. But I remember the day vividly. We pulled into this gas station. I was sitting there all bummed because I had this beautiful girlfriend, and we broke up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was that day.
And I was just, like, bumming. And he goes, you feel that?
Yeah.
You feel that?
Right.
And you got to take that and use it, and, like, that's where it's at, and that's why, and, like, a lot of stuff made sense.
Yeah, because when Marvin Gaye did What's Going On, that album, Marvin Gaye was a smooth cat. Mm-hmm. If you remember before What's Going On album, Marvin Gaye was suited up, was smooth, but Marvin...
He stepped into the movement right when he released that. And that record, that record is a veiled Black Power movement record. Wow. And if you really listen to the lyrics now, knowing that, like, go back and listen to that lyric. Oh, that whole fucking record is like, how did nobody tell me that this was like this?
Yes.
It's almost like as if Rage Against the Machine would have been a surprise. Like, if their name was, like, just called Complacency. Right. And then you bought the record and all of a sudden you're like, oh, my gosh, it says fuck the government.
Yeah.
that's kind of what happened with that record, man. Interesting. That what's going on? Oh, those lyrics.
Yeah, because Barry Gordy was like, this is not what you do.
It was so.
He was like, you gotta.
It was so pretty. But man, those lyrics.
Yeah. Like, and he had on a denim outfit with little stones on it. He was like, and change your outfit. You look like a bum.
Yeah. What the hell is wrong with you?
And that album went on to be like his best work.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, he felt that.
Right.
He was in the midst of it. How can he not?
And the greatest thing is, that's a light rock sound.
Yeah.
It's a very angry lyric behind it.
Mm.
Imagine trying to put your anger into a light rock format.
That's
not so easy, you know? And he did it. He made it sound smooth.
And that's why I wish I could be in the studio with stuff like that going down. When he starts to da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da. Like, where's all that coming from? And that band is just probably like, go with this, go with it.
Yeah, like, yeah. He knows what he's doing.
Marvin's going, just go with it.
Some people are kind of genius. I mean, like, I think Brian's that way. I brought him up before, Brian Reisling. He's one of the most genius players I've ever seen. Like, he comes into any band, and within seconds, he can just drop right into your style and your fit and find something that works. Awesome. In multiple keys. He'll bring, like, two different saxes or three different saxes. Like, who does that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt pretty privileged to work with anybody like that, and even to be able to jam with people, you know, that get it and that it play and all those different. Mm-hmm.
So when you produce, because I remember, like, I think we was talking before you came, like, there was a time when, I can't remember when we brought it up actually, but it was a time when artists used to be, it was right before you came, I was talking about when Biggie and Bone Thugs and Harmony produced a record, like, he was saying, and this was like 96, he was like, oh no, it wasn't none of that email me your verse. We were all in the fucking studio doing it. Like,
same place.
What is that like now? Is that when it comes to recording and producing, is it all this shit, I'll sing you mine? And
it's so international, like, you got it, like, yeah.
Yeah, okay, because the international, just, that makes sense, especially yeah. instead of somebody just being fucking lazy.
Yeah, like, what would you even say the percentage of artists that you've physically met is that you worked with?
Yeah.
There's been way less than, you know, I've, not a lot of them.
Right.
Especially when I worked with Jamaica for so long. For about 10 years, I worked with the biggest distribution label out of Jamaica, and they would send me stuff to work on here in, mm-hmm. in Oregon, and either Ashland or Williams or Talent, wherever I was at the time, mm-hmm. Small Axe Studios was mm-hmm. pretty mobile.
It's mobile. Yeah. Now, were you mastering and mixing at that point for them?
Yeah.
Okay.
And if they needed a bass track, if they needed a keyboard track or a guitar or anything, I'd throw it on there. And
okay.
Take care of it.
So when these artists get to that point, like when, like actually Bone Thugs and Harmony is just talking about this, how they're just now owning their masters.
Interesting. Mm.
So what does that mean to these artists? Because I remember like years ago when Ray Charles was one of the first to own his masters. Like, when did motherfuckers start realizing what it mean? Because the word master says a lot in that situation.
It's like, very debatable.
Yeah, part of that is a ugly side of things. Because
I'm going to say Prince is partially responsible for that.
That's right. When he put Slave on his face, right? Wasn't even that right before,
the time? Just his negotiation style. He was one of the first artists to ask for exclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
Ask for rights.
There is there's a dark side to music, and
oh yeah,
like yeah. we could talk about that for just a minute because it is it'll bring us to a spot. So like contracts and that kind of thing, it can be so wrong. And just B.B. King never made money for years, like ever. Like he got so screwed by his management and that kind of thing. So that's one ugly side of it. Is the bureaucratic side of it, the paperwork, the contracts, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. That can turn really ugly really fast. But another thing that sucks about music or bands is when people don't get along, and you watch these behind the scenes stories about Journey. Okay, just
yeah.
for one example,
or Fleetwood Mac.
Fleetwood Mac, yes.
The singer from Journey, Steve Perry. He'd ride in his own tour bus. He never hung out with the band. They never, like, linked and got along. And then in this documentary I was watching, and he's like, I never felt like I was part of the band.
Because you chose not to be.
Right. And the rest of the guys were like, he said that? That's so bizarre. Like, why would anybody say that? So they're not even friends. They're not even right. friends. And, like, I watched that, and that's when I was living in Williams at the time, and I was walking down the street to the general store that's, like, this old 100-year general store, this mountain town, you know, it's in the middle of nowhere.
It's the only store.
And I thought to myself, I kind of made it. Like, I'm okay. I don't have those demons behind me. I'm not bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Like the Journey bass player, bankrupt.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember just hearing like, about that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, the way it normally works with a young band especially is young bands and bands that have no representation that sign to a label typically don't understand all of what they're signing.
True.
And what they'll do is they'll give you this advance,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, yeah.
And the advance allows you to live your dream for a minute because you get to buy your new outfits
for a minute
and your better guitar and all the stuff that you wanted that you said, like, if I make it, I'm going to get all this stuff, right? Oh, yeah. So then you buy all the stuff. And then what you don't realize in your contract is that you actually owe that back through mm-hmm. royalties. So if your albums don't sell as well as they want them to, you actually owe money yeah. back based on what they gave you as an advance, right? So what happens to a lot of bands is then they get stuck in a cycle of mm-hmm. touring.
Yeah,
it's like a loan. Like somebody gives you a loan.
They're forced to tour
yeah.
on their own expense. They're not getting paid for it mm-hmm. at all. They're paying off a debt mm-hmm. for it.
And that's what
the only thing they actually get to keep a lot of times is their merchandise, which is why it's so important. Yeah. Like if you really support an artist, grab some merch because normally anymore it's not CDs, it's not radio play, you don't get any of that. You only get merch. And sometimes a little bit of ticket sales, if you're lucky. And so normally people take this deal, and it's the only deal they have, and they think, well, we're finally going to have a marketing team, right? They're going to push us.
Mm-hmm.
So they go and they record this record, and they owe all this money, and then they wait because they're like, oh, man, can you wait for it? They're going to put us in magazine ads and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they're, like, looking around. They're going, like, where's all the ads? Like, how come we're not in any magazines? Mm-hmm. How come our album is not on a billboard anymore? Yep. How come we're not in a commercial? How come we're not in an MTV spot? Like, what's going on? And then they start making phone calls that never get returned.
Yeah. Right?
And the people literally go, our deal was we will pay for your recording and we'll pay you this advance and then you owe us back. Advance. That was our that was our deal.
Just scares me because you know
it's a loan.
You know where the Wild Goose is, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm in there, it's a bar and there's this guy, he's all slumped over and he's drinking and I'm like, "Hey bro, what's going on?" He's like, I lost everything." And I'm like, "What's up?" And he's like, "I'm a musician and I was given like $100,000 like advance." And he goes, "I bought a house and then my wife left." And I'm like, "Bro." And it's just a terrible story. And I think that in hip hop for a while, it was really bad where it's like, "Oh, you want a record deal?" Which everybody does. Everybody's hungry for that. So it's like, here's this loan that we're going to give you that you're going to go bankrupt and you're just going to fail and bomb and fail.
Yeah, unless you're one of the, you know, one out of 100 who actually makes a silver release. Yeah.
And they don't tell you that. They don't tell you any of that. Like, "Oh, all the ideas you came up for this stage production?
Right.
Oh, yeah, we pay for that." You know what I mean? They don't tell you any of that until
the original thing you brought up was really rights, and you're absolutely, you're correct. So, like, for example, they a good, even in, on a good deal, you try to get people screwing the artist sometimes, like with Michael Jackson, he had all these special things he developed, like those shoes with the hooks in them for him to be able to do his lean. And they straight up through the studio tried to take that as intellectual rights. "No, you developed that as part of your stage show with us. That's part of our, we own the rights to the show." Yeah. And he was able to fight back some of that.
Yeah.
But that's why it's so important. Like when you're talking about owning your masters, it's something that doesn't happen if you're on a deal. It just doesn't happen anymore because that's the point of the deal. That's the leverage they have against you.
Yeah.
Is they own your master, and because they own your master, they own you.
Didn't Michael Jackson get the Beatles masters?
Yeah, he did. Yeah,
through a really weird contract negotiation, the Beatles weren't allowed to repurchase their own music unless they had it had been sold a certain amount of times. And so Michael Jackson actually claims that he bought that to be able to resell back to them because he would be the last owner in that number of times it had to be resold before it could be sold back.
Shit.
But then he never resold it
to
them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, him and Paul were boys. Like, say.
They were boys.
Yeah. What you want? And you pull that shit,
Michael? Can you imagine
that?
Can you imagine if I ended up owning your music?
Michael turned to him one day and Michael turned to him one day and said, "Hey, I'm gonna buy all your songs one day." And Paul McCartney
goes, Yeah, right, Michael.
And it happened.
Yeah, right, Michael. We'll walk the fuck out of here.
No, that's a good point though. I think that's why it's cool to talk about all this stuff with music. I think this episode to me was always gonna be special because I love everything about music. And I've seen so many people chase the dream of getting signed and then some of them stay and some of them kind of crash and burn. It just depends on what it is. But to me, I think that the most important thing about music is that it was something that it isn't anymore. And it's something that I hope we can someday get back.
Yeah.
And part of what was so amazing about music is the power that we gave to music. We assigned it a certain amount of power back in the day.
Big time.
When that new record was coming out, it was like the only thing you were thinking about. It's the same thing people do when they camp out to see a stupid Star Wars
movie.
People used to camp out at the record store at the mall, you know, to see, get that new Prince record come out. You wanted to be the first one.
Concert too.
And it's also because it used to be, the ownership was a big deal. It wasn't like that song was going to be on the radio for a while when that album came out. So if you were that friend that had the record, everybody wanted to come to your house and listen to the new Zeppelin record or whatever it was. It was kind of a cool communal thing. It's like, "Hey man, I got this new Tina Turner.
Yep.
Come over and check it out." And you get all your boys together.
And that's what I appreciate about my mom, her love for music. Because my mom had album covers, rows that could come out to hear. She had albums. And Marvin Gaye said the best, music is the soul of the man.
Yep.
So I remember my mom would be playing Yellow Brick Road, or she'll be playing Doobie Brothers, or whatever she's playing, I can tell that's what mood she's in. Something's going on. You know what I mean? It was like,
yeah, we talk about a certain record. Certain records come on, you stay away from mom.
She was playing some James Ingram, she's heartbroken, some shit. Just, you know, or that fucking debauch.
Yeah.
"A dream, a simple fan." That was the one Tupac sampled for. I ain't mad at you.
Oh, yeah.
But that was my mom's song. I knew my mom was having a hard time. And most like some relationship drama.
Oh, my mom's was Air Supply.
Yeah.
When that, "I'm all out of love, so lost." That shit would come on. I was like, "Oh, dad fucked up. Dad's in the doghouse."
Yeah, I remember Bohemian Rhapsody a lot growing up.
Yeah.
I don't know what that would mean. I hope that wasn't the song that they played when they're mad, though, because that'd be a really weird choice.
I know.
So I want to know, before we get too lost in conversation, talk to me a minute about where people can find some of the music you worked on. Because we always try to, like, you know, help people for our guests. Mm-hmm. They want to look up your work and stuff like that. And I know there's so many things that you could plug, but over the years, it'll probably even change about which stuff you choose you want people to see. But
it's,
what would you say?
In that zone right now where I'm like, I'm not pushing some of the stuff I kind of want to take off the internet. And
right. Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's with age.
I'm ready to get some new stuff out there.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
So,
but if there was a place to send people, where would you feel safe for them to check out your work?
What would you feel
or maybe,
safe?
Or maybe drop a record that you would say, like, oh, man, check out this record. I did this on that.
I mean, there's tons of YouTube links, but I can't really say a link and this kind of thing right now. But
Well, we can
you'll have to stay tuned too. Because I'm really into my new music, and I kind of
want. That's what I'm talking about.
So, what are you working on right now, then?
Yeah, there we go.
I have a lot of instrumental kind of stuff that I'm really having a great time with because I'm playing at these wineries where I'll show up and I've got a loop pedal that's got a bunch of different.
Those are that's so awesome. Dope.
Tracks in it already, and I can just play over them and I like different sections. Here's a chorus. Here's a bridge. Here's the and then I just started writing a bunch of songs, and so now I've got a very long set that I can play at these wineries and that kind of thing. And I really enjoy doing it because
that's cool, man.
It's super mellow music. And the thing that's cool about it is it's not a meme-y thing like at all. Like I'll play it like I love playing at Schmidt Winery. It's really swanky and nice or whatever, but it creates a vibe for people to chill and have fun.
Yeah. Right.
And I also
you don't have to be the centerpiece of it. You can be like part of the painting.
Totally. Yeah. And I'm sitting there thinking, what would I want to hear? Would I want to hear some guy up there going, or something a little.
Serve the fucking song. If there's only one thing you learn from this, it's
like you said, know your crowd.
Yeah, know that crowd.
Know your crowd.
Know that crowd.
At a winery, you're not going to want that.
So what are you playing under?
It's going to be a guy sitting with his girl. That's the last thing he wants to deal with, you know?
So what name are you playing under for this project?
Anthony Cosenza.
Oh, very cool. So just under your name, and like, what do you got coming up?
Let's see.
Keep in mind, it takes a while for this show to come out. So feel free to push stuff that's after the first of the year.
Let's put the date. Let's put the actual date on that bitch.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm playing with the Roadsters.
Okay.
A local cover band that they play a lot of weddings, a lot of parties, and a lot of venues around here. I've been doing shows with them nearly every weekend since I've been with them for the last, like, 3 months.
Oh, wow.
And they've been around for 10-plus years.
Totally been around and established in the Valley, and I'm very happy to see how they kick ass. People come out and see them, and they put on a great professional show. Mm. I get to play with these guys. They're very good, and that's what I'm mostly doing now. You'll see we just played two nights last night and the night before at Grape Street.
Oh, there you go.
Mm. And, they had the whole place full the whole night, so I can't complain. Like, the shows have been great, and I'm getting to stretch out. I get to play some country, and
we
were talking about Sweet Home Alabama. And that was our sound check, I think, the night before or something like that. There's a bit of that going on.
Yeah.
But the thing is like I'm at a point where I'm finding that fun because I'm not going to try sticking, just staying in one box.
Can't
like
right.
country country guitar, those some badass boys. Oh, like man. In Nashville, that's
Wild
where.
Is cap. You're right. They are.
They're wicked. There's
for sure.
It's really challenging to do it. And so I'm having fun kind of messing around with that tone and that kind of vibe.
Nice. Well, I encourage you to go out and see this man play because I have seen him play through various iterations. I think the first thing I saw you in was Cultivators, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been interesting throughout the years, but definitely go check out his work. And we will have some links that we can probably, by the time they...
I'll get you some
throw up some YouTube links for you to check out. But I really appreciate you being here.
Yeah, man.
And thanks taking time with us.
Thanks, you guys.
Super awesome. And again, Ross Cricket.
Yeah.
That's how I've always known. So I appreciate you just being here and always appreciate our chances to jam. So
thank you.
Major props. Thanks for talking to these boys.
It's fun for me hanging out with some comedians because
I
look at your guys' industry and I want it to thrive just as much as music because we're all entertainers, and that is not easy to do.
It's not easy.
Right. For some people, it's the scariest thing ever.
Yeah, it is, man. And one thing I appreciate what you were saying, like, know your audience, because a kid who I've been working with, he hit me up because he got a gig up in Seattle. And he gets there. He's like, oh, they want a PG-13 show. I don't have PG-13. And I was like, at this point, you should never be able to say I don't have. You got to be able to be ready for your audience. Because I know you got to have a catalog full of jams because it's at a winery.
Different crowd. Yeah.
So
different.
It's like when you go somewhere, man, you got to be able to have, I told him, I said, put a set together and just take out the profanity, sexual, visual stuff. But you have it. You have it. You just got to.
You don't realize it.
You just gotta got to put your shit together and make sure you're ready for it. Because somebody call you up and ready to do it, you can't be like, I don't have it. Like, then you're not a pro.
And did that change his game?
Yeah, he thought about it. I said, then you're not a pro. I said, you're not a professional because people are putting you in positions to do shows now. Like, they want to, you have no excuse.
It's great advice.
With anything.
Yeah, how bad do you want it?
Yeah, step exactly. because you attract shit. That's how it works. In this business, you attract people. It goes back to this old saying, it's not what you know, but who you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I guarantee I could say,
like Carl, I mean, you wouldn't have had half your opportunities that had not been for me.
Maddie, if it wasn't for fucking Maddie, I wouldn't even be in Medford.
Kind of a big deal over here. I don't like to brag, but brag.
Kind of a big deal. Brag, but brag.
No, seriously, I miss filming this show. Thank you guys for waiting for a while our new ones to come out.
That's great. I enjoyed listening to you guys all talk about your musical experiences growing up because you guys are all 40 years older than me, so it's
we are.
You were like, I didn't even know they made music then. I thought it was just like sticks and rocks.
I know, exactly.
They had instruments?
What? Wow. What? That's too funny.
No, well, I look forward to coming and seeing you guys doing something somewhere.
Yeah, man. Hopefully Maddie puts some dope-ass shows here at his home with some beautiful shows.
Yeah,
great shows, to do that. Man. And they can check me out at Chadwick's every weekend. I put on my show. I got touring comics that come from all over.
Very cool.
Up in there, man. Every weekend is popping.
It's a good show, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Our producer, Levi, too. You don't get to see him yet, but we're going to have Levi on an upcoming show very soon.
Yeah, we will.
And Levi, also, great comic. And I get to work with Levi every once in a while.
And he produced shows with Black Market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Black Market Comedy. There's gave me my first shot. I did a show with them last week.
Wow.
It's great.
He actually uses Levi sandbags to hold down the lighting here.
That's true. That's true.
That he made himself.
He damn sure does. Got fucking sandbags.
Levi used sandbagging, son of a gun.
Levi cut us some Levi jeans.
We're gonna have to put a still.
This podcast is sponsored by Levi Jeans 501s.
We'll have to put a still a still image of this man up so you guys can see what Levi looks
like. Exactly. Put it right back there.
We could actually make him look like whoever we want. They don't really know what he looks
Hell
like.
Yeah.
Sloth from
he could just look like a really
dude. You said, that's so funny you said that because I never watched the Goonies and yesterday I started watching it.
You never watched
it. The credits was coming on.
What do you mean started watching it like it's a Netflix series?
I never seen it.
He says it like it's a Netflix series. I started watching it.
Right. Well,
I didn't get very far because Carl's old. He falls asleep.
I had to go somewhere, but I was like, let me watch this shit. But
it's a good movie. That was filmed in Oregon, Astoria.
Yeah, but all those kids became amazing adult stars. Mm-hmm. And guess what I watched right after that?
What?
The Outsiders.
Oh, okay.
What?
Stay gold.
Another one where the young bucks were but young back then became amazing stars.
Yeah.
But so those movies were great.
Yeah, that's some good
Goonies came. Outsiders came out in 1983, and Goonies came out in 1985.
Wow!
So that was
amazing work. The first Star Wars came out in 77.
Sure did. And Superman
77.
And Superman came out in 78.
I came out in 91.
I came out in 78, coincidentally. Anyway. Well, thank you guys for listening to the Heckle Proof podcast. As always, if you like what you hear, we hope that you do like and subscribe. But more importantly than anything else, we don't have a giant budget. So if you would like other people to hear us, we can only humbly ask that you tell your friends, family, loved one, and or enemies about the show.
That's right.
Everybody and anybody.
HeckleProofPodcast.com.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, and follow us wherever fine podcasts are streaming.